Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, the immaculate. Now listen to this.
Last day of the Somatic Winter Summertime Show.
Yay!
We made it. The long national nightmare is over, and I am celebrating on Friday by going to the Winter Chaos Conference in Springfield, Massachusetts. So there you go, if anybody cares. I'm sure that it just sailed right over the infield. Just saw it on Yahoo. I don't even know this, but Lynn Redgrave's daughter and Liam Neeson's wife, Natasha Richardson, has passed away from her skiing accident up in Quebec. No details were especially, you know, I mean, this time of the year when you get into spring skiing or late season skiing, there's just so many accidents. I mean, skiing is one of those sports to me that it's like, you never have to do certain things in life, and for some reason, she's 45 years old. I don't know, she was a beginner skier, no helmet. You know, that's sad. I just found that sad. I didn't even know all the ties. I didn't know there was Lynn Redgrave's daughter. All that stuff. I just found out.
No, I didn't know that either. Actually.
Yeah, it kind of took me for a loop. But so that was going on, and sad that hear that news. And then I don't know if you were watching it before, but President Obambam took his microphone out west, and I think he's still running a campaign. Did he tell me one? He can go govern now? Half the state of California was angry at him, and he was doing his dancing best up there. I had the mute on because I couldn't watch him get abused anymore. And basically what's happened in the last 2 months, it's almost as if, you know, Bush did one of those, like, the old vaudeville things where they kind of dance off the stage, you know, with the cane and the hat. And Obama comes out right when they're about to start throwing all the tomatoes in the garbage, right before the hook comes out, you know. So the Congress that was corrupt under Bush, and everybody was making millions, and the Wall Streeters that were making millions, they could care less that there was going to be hell to pay at a certain point, because everybody was making money hand over fist. And, of course, the traditional code of Wall Street is, you don't go to jail. You get, like, a golden parachute, and you go home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now you see someone like Bernie, you know, going to the Iron Gate Hotel, and he's not too happy. And then today they scooped up his accountant, who's looking at 100 years. It's like that Bugs Bunny. Cheer up, Doc. 99 years isn't forever. You know, yeah, I just can't relate to it anymore. The whole thing is so silly. And then Senator Dodd admitted to putting a loophole in the stimulus for the bonuses. So there's scam, scam, scam. So it really doesn't matter what side of the damn aisle you are. I mean, that's why.
Did you see some of that was paid back?
Yes, of course. Well, they're going to tax these bastards now, 90% on the dollar, I guess. So that the money goes back, but it's just gotten to the point where I really think we need to have that big arm come down, you know, that sweeps all the pins away in the bowling alley, and just wipe all this stuff off the planet, because the entire system is so goddamn corrupt. I can't even look at it anymore. It's almost like dealing with like extended family at a bad wedding. It's like one cousin is more, you know, disgusting and over made up than the other. Like, enough with your garbage. I can't deal with you anymore. I really think, you know, the blame is ultimately going to form at the feet of the Fed, and it's going to be glorious. Because the Federal Reserve, as you know, is a corrupt cartel, unaccountable to many. And once we do that, and we close the doors of the IRS, and we stop all this garbage, like, I'll give you an example. Like, me paying for my dopey ticket to get the stink in Denver. And by the way, if you're listening to the show and you're in Colorado, me and my Soma circus will be coming to town in a couple of weeks as I wrestle with this damn orange. On April 2nd, you can go to the website and put on somaspace.org/somaday.html, all the details, or you can email us at nakedsoma@gmail.com. Seats available. And we'll be talking about the healing power of somatic profiling, to know thy symptom. And so we'll be doing that in Broomfield on April 2nd. And just a half-day, little workshop-y kind of thing. Introduce you to the somatic world beneath your awareness. And hopefully, mm-hmm. like I said, the schools out there, of course, have widely and largely poo-pooed me. I've been poo-pooed. Oh, little Soma boy, you run along now. But, you know, you don't do that to me. I'm like a bad penny.
Scumbag.
That's right. And I'll be coming in, even if it means going to their doorstep to send them a little turd stool, it'll happen.
Personally, I think the guy's a phony.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you go to the website there, I do kind of give a little introduction about what my experience has been. Because the perception, sitting here high atop the streets of Larchmont, is that that is Soma Valley, because there's, I think, literally five schools out there teaching and talking and sitting in their little lotus position, doing their Soma best. When you come a-calling, they don't want your Soma. And that's one of the problems. This is the model that, you know, like we saw with the kids in school. Psychology gives them a bunch of maps with no territory, and you either subscribe to what Adler says or Freud said or Jung said, or you're in no man's land,
mm-hmm.
or you start popping pills, or worse, start talking to a therapist who's popping pills. That should be like one of those words in the culture. Mental health professional. Warning, warning, warning. This person has been given a lot of maps. So, you know, and between that and now I look over here and I see that Jeff Zucker is slashing out at the Jon Stewart for his criticisms of Kramer. So now we have a comedian criticizing a huckster from CNBC, who was like one of the biggest hedge fund guys back when there was money.
Money. Hmm.
Back in the day when there was money.
Uh-huh.
And basically, he thinks that he made a scapegoat out of Kramer, who, you know, if you cherry pick some of his predictions, was basically stumping for the very banks that are now, of course, in the dinosaur pile.
I'd like to take Kramer by his nads.
Yeah, the people that are in the market.
I hate that.
Well, he basically, what his job was to take the people that were running around with their discretionary income and get them into the market, get the newbies, get the neophytes, get the ne'er-with-alls into the market, and get their money in there so that the guys that knew how to manipulate them could take advantage of them. So he would just leapfrog them and give them horrible freaking predictions. I mean, I've never seen the guy stick to a prediction for more than a day.
But he only did that so he could he benefits from it. You know, he's a vile, vile creature. And wait, let me just click this for a second here. Just
yeah. And these two. Bach, Wiley, cocksucker.
Yeah, all right. That's all I need. I see someone calling in here.
Already? Right. Okay, we're almost at time.
Well, I don't know if that's right. The person. Where are they calling from? Local?
Yeah.
Okay. It's probably them then.
I'm going to choke on this damn orange. Oh, here we go. One second. Oh, yeah, that's him. All right. We might as well get there now, because before the generation ends, or before I need the Heimlich and the cleaning staff leaves. So click them through. I'll look for the siren.
All right. You ready?
No. Where is it now?
It's in there. It's in there.
Is it under Soma or a submarine or one or the other?
I don't know.
You know, this is what I hate.
Diving.
Every
it's
week,
under diving horn, I think.
Under diving horn.
I don't remember.
No, you see, you do this every week. You change the label.
It's the same place.
It's not even in alphabetical order. All right, here we go.
Well, that's not.
All right. Joining us now from an undisclosed location north of New York City, editor at Larger Details Magazine, author of X Saves the World, which has the best subtitle ever, How Generation X Got the Shaft But Can Still Keep Everything from Sucking, Jeff Gordinier. Welcome to Summertime.
Thanks, Mark. What's going on?
Well, we just heard the tragic news about Liam Neeson's wife.
Yeah, that's a bummer. That's some sad stuff, yeah.
So Obama out there doing his Friends, Romans, Countrymen speech out there in California with the rocks and garbage being thrown at him by the good people in Southern California who are just not happy.
Yeah, my home state. I apologize for that.
Well, you know, it's sort of the litmus test to see if the country's going to put up with anything is if you look at the West Coast and if they're freaking out, what are we doing back here?
That's true. Everything starts on the West Coast.
Yeah, if they've had it, if they're going taxi, yeah, we've hit the threshold. Yeah. Jay Leno keeps adding shows. You know, Philly Jones is going to start spontaneously playing in Central Park, and it's all over. So, I'm about a third of the way through the book. I got it yesterday, thanks to your crack staff.
Yeah, cool.
That was amazing.
Great. I'm glad you're liking it.
Yeah, Megan the Penguin over there doing her virtual damnest to get things going, and the book has a personality, which is rare for a book.
Oh, good. I don't like boring books. I'm sort of old school in that way. I like books to be entertaining. And I'm actually up here in my office, and I'm looking at my books, and the books I see are, you know, by Hunter S. Thompson and Tom Wolfe and Kenneth Tynan and Joan Didion and people like that who I think just had really strong voices. I don't know that I'm in their league, but they're definitely people who are an influence on me, particularly Tom Wolfe. I just didn't want to write something that was dull, you know, and I wanted it to be funny. So I hope it is.
You took a topic. I mean, it's one of those things where a lot of times, especially when you're writing from, in a first-person sense, being part of a generation, writing about that generation, you're sort of speaking for the rest of us. And, of course, that's going to lead to polarization, yays, nays, and people going, what do you know, and things like that. And you have about, I don't know, maybe about 8 or 9 pages in the beginning there where there's a zillion disclaimers. And and then after the disclaimers, there's the virtual sort of middle finger that goes up that I don't care if you have a problem with this. I'm going to write this anyway, and you put all these and it's the best thing I've seen in terms of writing a book about pop culture from someone who studies pop culture and knowing their reader is sitting there with their little snarkiness going, hey, I disagree with that.
Yeah.
Because there's that tendency. Anytime anyone starts to pontificate about anything, really, especially this culture, that to agree with them is to acquiesce, is to give, it's almost like a territorial loss.
Yes.
To concur.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I have been that snarky reader, you know.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I have been on the other side of it and have sneered and snickered at the author in question. So I guess I was stealing myself for that. I mean, it's interesting. I'll tell you something. It's weird. This is my first book, and came out in hardcover about a year ago, and now the paperback's out. And I haven't even talked about this anywhere, but I'll talk about it with you. Like, when you put out a book like this, it changes you because you get – I mean, I get emails every day from people who loved it, and I get emails every day from people who hate it. And,
right.
And you know, I've been eviscerated. I've been celebrated. And, like, it really – becomes depersonalized for you at a certain point. Like, you're like, well, I did it. You know what? I used to have a very thin skin, and now I'm like thickest skin you can imagine. I genuinely don't care, which is incredibly liberating now. I just don't care. Like, I love it when people liked it. I mean, obviously, that's an honor to hear that from people, and particularly when it's they say it actually kind of inspired them or something, even though that's sappy to say, it's like a lovely thing to hear. But when people slag on it, you know, sometimes the criticisms are genuine, and I listen to them like, okay, cool, you know, you disagree. And part of it is that, like, you know, obviously I slag on the boomers pretty hard, and I slag on the millennials pretty hard, the generation that comes up after Generation X, but it's meant to be a joke, really. You know, it's like it's meant to be humorous, sort of hyperbolically humorous writing. And people who get that, like you clearly get it, like, are laughing their heads off and think it's fun. But the boomers in particular don't always get it, Mark. And, like, I will get some really dead serious, earnest, angry emails from them about – and I don't know that they – like, they don't – boomers, I've found, really don't like it when you pick on their legacy. You know, they're very self-serious and self-congratulatory about their legacy, which almost makes me think I didn't go far enough.
Yeah, well, small sample for me, just forwarding it around to people in my circle. You know, just forwarding even the YouTube clip, which I think is hilarious in the sense that you do this sort of the VH1 Behind the Music black and white thing.
That's right. That's true. Yeah, my friend Russ Spencer did that. I wanted to give credit to him. He's like, I used to be a rock critic in Santa Barbara, California, and Russ was just a pal of mine there, and he's turned into this videographer, and he was kept saying, dude, I'm telling you, you have to do like a YouTube thing. And I was like, really? I mean, that seems kind of cheesy. He's like, no, I'll do it in a way that will really work. And it's totally his doing. I mean, I had nothing to do with it. He basically trained a camera on me, and we wanted it to be sort of mock serious with the black and white. And
that's what I'm saying. It gets that whole thing going on. It's like, and then the world turned. And it's one of those things where it's like that's become sort of the obligatory way to promote something, like MTV was maybe circa 83, 84, when every album had to come out and you had to put the first single, had to have a video.
Yeah, that's right.
At a certain point, the video preceded the album. You know, they kind of jumped ahead. But and the thing is that, like I said, that unapologetic tone that the book takes about basically cross-examining Generation X, first in a very sort of like, you know, almost self-loathing way that started from the original article you wrote, and then it goes through this like, you know, transformation that when you realize that, you know, if not for us, what are we stuck with?
Yeah.
You know.
That's well put.
You know.
Better put it than I did. But yeah, like, yeah, I agree. Like, that's funny you say this, because, okay, so the title of the book is X Saves the World. Obviously, that's one big generational ironic wink, you know, yeah, ha-ha, nobody's going to save the world. And yet, like, when I sent the proposal out to do this book, it was originally a much more negative concept. I mean, it was really like, put a fork in us, we're done.
Right.
It was, I mean, And it wasn't just that I thought the book had to have some Hollywood uplift, you know, that it had to have a happy ending. As I did research, I genuinely began to meet Xers who I felt were doing cool things. And as you get farther into the book, it becomes a little less jokey. And there are people like Cameron Sinclair from Architecture for Humanity and these guys, Matthew Zapruder and Joshua Beckman, who put together this poetry bus, and Majora Carter from Sustainable South Bronx. These people are doing really cool things, and not just nonprofit things, but doing it in a new way, a way I found really inspiring. And so the X Saves the World, I'm saying long-windedly, actually I began to believe it. And I believe it just the way you put it, that I think maybe Xers are the ones, you know, literally keeping everything from sucking. So, you know, in terms of culture, in terms of volunteerism, in terms of business. I mean, just look at the businesses that Xers have created: Google, Yahoo, YouTube, Amazon.com, Craigslist, Netflix, on and on and on. I mean, these companies, like them or hate them, have reinvented global business and probably are the only places hiring right now. So praise be to Xers for that.
Well, again, I think one of the biggest contributions that maybe kind of pops out, almost like one of those stereogram things in Seinfeld, is that Xers as individuals, I don't even know if we got together and had a meeting about this in our little, you know, collective consciousness here, but we sort of tend to eschew the fourth wall. And no matter what industry we're in, no matter what avenue of sort of like creative pursuit we're in, we're very comfortable with the behind the scenes, the transparency, the, you know, sort of like, we're not going to fake this. Like the chick on the plane that does the whole thing with the seatbelt. I mean, we're not doing it.
Right.
So I picked up a book randomly off my shelf here, a book called Pain Free by Peter Gaskew, a former Marine. And, you know how you pick up these health books and basically they give you, like, you know, before you do this exercise program, consult with 10 doctors, and, you know, because the whole lawyer thing comes in, right? So here's what Pete does, and he's an Xer. From, you know, my part of the Xer, mid-60s.
Uh-huh. Yeah, me too.
He says, it's become obligatory for health books to carry a legal disclaimer. You read them. The following material is not intended as a substitute for the advice of a physician. Then they go on to recommend you consult a doctor for embarking on whatever programs you offer. They conclude with the author and the publisher disclaiming any legal responsibility for adverse consequences. As I did in my first book, I urge readers who feel they need to have a disclaimer's protection and counsel to close the cover and leave the pages unread. My working principle as an author and exercise therapist is that most important consultation is the one the person has with themselves. Healthcare starts a personal responsibility. Any disclaimer that suggests otherwise does a great disservice.
Awesome.
I mean, only an Xer who has sort of looked at the stage that he has to perform on and said, I'm not going to put some phony disclaimer on my work.
Yeah.
He puts the FU disclaimer on his work.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And that's, I think it sort of bled into a lot of things that we, like, you know, now the rage all of a sudden, I don't know if it happened to you, but like Facebook and Twitter just exploded after the election.
Yeah, of course,
okay?
Yeah.
And people now it's become like almost like on every damn show, because again the fourth wall is gone.
Yeah.
That they're multitasking during the show. You can't watch a news program. We're getting a Twitter. It's like,
yeah, that's right.
It's like now you're not watching television. You're watching people multitask on television.
That's true.
Or you're multitasking while you're watching on television. And
I think any minute now we're going to have a reality show about people watching reality shows. Like
they were at that point. And right now Val is probably multitasking as she's listening to us talk. And
yeah,
you know,
I am.
Are you Twittering? I mean, you know, so
no.
I'm actually looking at porn here. So I'm totally kidding.
See,
I'm focused, man. I'm totally focused.
That is a true eco at work over there.
That's right. We're all
yeah.
eco. Forget it. We can triple
there,
task.
One, we can't going in a straight line is a complete accident. If any one of us makes a point, you know, that would be a miracle. So let's get into some of the nuts and bolts of the book here. It's like you said it. In writing the book, basically you became a little crusty around the accolades and the people with their problems with the book.
Well, no, it's just that like you get to the point where like you hear people say great things and you hear people say negative things, and sometimes this is being completely blunt, they're both wrong. Like you think, well, the book's not actually that good, dude. And then with the other guy, you're like, you know, I disagree. I mean, I don't think I said that at all. I think you missed the point. And then there are people who say great things and negative things, and you kind of agree with them. Like, I've become completely almost Buddhist about it. Like, I welcome all viewpoints. Like, it's weird. Like, I'm doing this panel discussion tomorrow night on Thursday night at McNally Jackson Bookstore down in Soho, and I'm doing it with Jeff Chang, wrote this great book about hip-hop. Karen Gisella co-authored a great book about how Sassy Magazine influenced, you know, girls coming up. And Doug Rushkoff, the legendary thinker and writer Douglas Rushkoff, we're on this panel together. And all these, it's interesting, Mark, because all these folks were saying to me, look, I'm happy to be part of this panel, but I really want to call BS where I see it. Like, I really want to talk about important issues and whether Gen X is even a real thing and whether it's a myth. And, you know, let's, like, really throw down and have an argument. And I was like, terrific. This is, like, the best news I've heard in a long time. Let's smash some assumptions, you know? I thought that was a very Gen X response. Like, I mean, again, like, you know, people say these are generalizations, but imagine a panel of four boomers together all agreeing, you know, on how great Sgt. Pepper's was, which is just so boring. And, like, with these four, I'm telling you, we're all going to disagree. We're going to disagree affectionately and spiritedly, I hope, and throw down and probably debunk everything we just said. But I love that. I mean, that's what I thrill to. I guess that's the kind of atmosphere I prefer, you know.
And
like,
and
not being reverent. Sorry.
This is like a continuum where you go from almost like that cordial agreement thing where everyone's just kind of professional and erudite in the boomer world where they're all basically in a kind of a block alignment, even though they might disagree under their breath, but they publicly they don't want to look like they have any, like, they don't want to look defensive.
Yeah.
And then you get to the Xers who are so kind of focused on, you know what, I'm not going to be phony for you.
Yeah.
And so they're sort of resolutely disagreeable even with themselves.
It's like, yeah, it's true. And I'll tell you, that's a huge challenge with selling this book. I'm being blunt with you. Because, like I meet a lot of people that are like, wow, you wrote a book about Generation X? I don't know, man. I we'll see. And
so 90s.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot of resistance, like Nirvana. They weren't as great as everybody says. That kind of, you know, I happen to have written a book for the generation that snickers at the very idea of a book for its generation. So trust me, dude, that's a Sisyphean challenge. Like, I have found that the only thing that works is the book itself. Like, when people actually pick it up, flip through the introduction, read a few lines, they're like, you know what, actually, this isn't bad. This is kind of funny. I like this. This is all right. And that has happened thousands of times now. I'm just like, can you just take a look at it? You might like it more than you think. I'm not as much of a dick as you think. Excuse me.
Well, to extend that argument, like, you get the Gen Xers, like I said, they sort of had to accept reality at its face because that's all they had to deal with, because they were just, you say, middle child in the culture and things like that. It was very real about that experience of sort of having everybody else just get favors done for them and this sense of work your way up the ranks, young man, and
yes,
then they would move the ladder.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, that's really well put. Yeah.
And then these bastard wives come in. I have a problem with them because they have this thing called fake outrage that they do very well, and they get nutty and they flame each other and they're blogging and it's all an act.
Yeah.
And when you talk to them, it's almost like their whole life is taking place in pro wrestling circles. It's like everything is sort of candied up. And there's nothing at the center of that wall for them that I can see. And they're young enough where you could quite sort of give them a little bit of rope. But I don't remember us getting to that point. I don't remember us having that in the mid-'80s where when the boomers, the phony part of the boomers were all going yuppie and they're all driving around and, you know, it was like, wait a minute, 20 years ago you were here and now you're...
Yeah.
You know, they just went right by me. And you know, I remember seeing like Glenn Frey, like, you know, like,
wow. Oh, he's like the king boomer, isn't he?
Yeah, I remember seeing him on an interview and he's all greased back. I'm like, what? What is this? Because I was like, you know, so into the Eagles as a little kid, and, you know,
yeah.
and then I'm watching this guy and it's like, you just everything seems like it's like that Planet of the Apes moment, you know.
That's funny.
You just go, those idiots, you know. And then you see when the wise came in. Almost accidentally, it's like maybe around Y2K was the seminal moment here when we just kind of like faded to black and they just kind of took over.
Yeah, that's right. That's
but,
true.
But that it was like in the aftermath of 9/11. I remember this distinctly because being in New York, it's like ingrained in your nervous system. It's like, you know, there was that window of about maybe 3 or 4 days between the looting and everything else before Bush came and, you know, stood into the bullhorn deal.
Yeah.
Where everybody was attempting to be nice to everybody. I mean,
yeah,
they were really generally attempting to be nice to everybody. And I just remember there was, you know, they were starting to put the memorial up downtown and you know, being a clinician and all that stuff, it was like I was basically working around the clock. I was taking care of firefighters running in. And
oh, wow.
I remember this deal. Oh, God, I don't remember the name of the guy. Where it was a BAI radio host. I forget his name. He's not in the air anymore. But he was admonishing everyone to basically, this was what we waited for. It was a whole boomer speech about how, you know, this is the clarion call, this is the consciousness. It was like he tried to combine the harmonic convergence and about 16 other things in the aftermath of 9/11, like the 100th monkey had sung. It was like, you know, all this crap. And I'm going, people are scared. Don't you understand?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And it was like they can't take anything that happens and just leave it where it is. They have to interpret it in that model that, you know, we have to consult Marilyn Ferguson first, and then she'll tell us what it means. And
that's,
you know,
so true. And I think they're hooked on this whole – they're basically hooked on this utopian idea – and they've spent so much time prattling on about utopia that they stopped doing anything to try to get us there. You know, it's first of all, I think I don't believe in any kind of utopia is ever going to happen. So let's just throw in the towel on that, dudes. But like, it's exactly, you're exactly right that they basically want to apply this framework to everything that happens. Like, one of the things that became really grating for me is to hear President Obama compared to President Kennedy over and over. Now, with great respect for both of them, but, you know, Obama's a whole new thing, okay? He's not, like, a reference point to the past. Obviously, his leadership, his ascension, his election is saturated with all sorts of his history, whether it's Dr. King,
yeah,
you know, or JFK. I mean,
the
there's all sorts
of... Yeah.
You know, he carries so much with him, but to constantly compare him to JFK does a disservice to both men. They're both incredibly different. They're individuals, and President Obama's campaign was just a new thing happening. But they can't seem to look at anything as a new thing. The boomers look at everything as an echo, right, of their legacy.
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, well, see, this is just what we saw in the early 60s. No, dude, it's different, all right? Can't you accept that it's like incredibly, it's like 50 years later and it's different. Like, I mean, we have, I just found out like the last few days that they're going to have a 40th anniversary Woodstock, okay? We're in the, it's this year, yeah, this marks the 40th anniversary Woodstock. And I thought, I was feeling good. Well, I mean, I guess I could like blog about it, so it should happen. But I was like, maybe we're going to get away with nothing happening. No echo, you know, of course, you know, Katie Couric will have a little, you know, Woodstock recollection thing. On.
So they'll send someone up to Sark and he's to stand in a field, and this is where...
Yeah, exactly. They always got to do that. Like, oh, you know, people were naked, man, and slopped around in the mud, and those,
yeah,
you know, it's so tiresome and repetitive. But no, they couldn't let it go. There's going to be a Woodstock, this four, I guess it'll be the fourth Woodstock, the 40th anniversary, in Berlin.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah, so it's not here at least. But
yeah.
I went to Woodstock 94.
I was reading about it in the book,
yeah,
and the paragraph that went on for about, I think, 37 words to describe the smell and the disgust was just, I read it out loud, actually. It was so funny.
But the thing is that, like, this must have smelled exactly like the first Woodstock smelled. And let me tell you something. You can see these pictures of naked hippie women, you know, and it looks kind of hot. You kind of think, wow, I wish I was there. Let me tell you, if it smelled anything like Woodstock 94, you do not wish you were there. It was basically one big potty. It was just vile.
Yeah, yeah, the porta-johns turned over, it flooded, everything was all running together, and they were throwing mud piles at the bands, and yeah, it was just disgusting. So the thing is, that kind of gets into another little secondary little eddy here that I kind of gleaned from the first part of the book, is that there's a tendency, and I don't know when it started, I guess maybe late 80s, early 90s, of this whole retro thing.
Yeah.
That I don't know if it was a millennial kind of like a groundswell, or because I think a little of that came from the Xers attempting to sort of wear the clothing and sort of act like their big brother for a while, and then they kind of pushed it away, and it was like, then it was ill. Then we all started wearing black.
Yeah,
you know?
That's true.
But for a while, we were trying to, like, do, like, the, you know, like, well, maybe this is the way to get popular. And it was such a disgusting little interval there from, like, 88 to, like, 90-something, 91, 92. And then Lollapalooza, you know, you tried to do the same things, and it just felt like this is tired.
Yeah,
and like when the internet started, we were the ones that were doing like the used groups and the muds and all the things that were.
Oh, absolutely,
around,
absolutely,
you know,
yeah.
Running around in there, I remember like finding Rushkoff in some obscure backwoods thing. You know, the guy still does media squat. I mean, that's how, you know, he had the hand crank model of the internet there.
Well, Rushkoff,
him and four Russians were on it, I think.
Rushkoff's so ahead of the curve on so many things. I mean, I think that guy deserves credit now. I mean, I would like to see... He has a new book coming out this summer called Life,
yeah,
Inc.
Life Inc., yeah. We're going to have him on the show in May.
It's a fantastic book, and it's really timely. It's about just sort of how consumerism devoured us all. And, I mean, you think of, like, viral marketing,
mm-hmm,
and, I don't know, just,
he's,
you
like
know, crowdsourcing. So many ideas. He was ahead of the curve on these things. It's like he was basically the first person I heard about this stuff from. So.
Yeah, that's kind of what when I first read Media Virus and some other books, I called him the buggles of the internet. He was the one that understood that, you know, they were going to commercialize this thing and ruin it.
Yeah.
And he's been proven right. But, you know, just that retro thing just kind of bugged me because it was like one of those things where we were so nondescript as a crowd. You know, 46 million of us wandering along individually trying to get a damn entry-level job when there was nothing, when it was downsized. And you just had to kind of fight for yourself. And then all those things blew up. Silicon Valley blew up. And then down here, Silicon Alley blew up. And,
yeah,
and so it just, all these little kind of circles of expertise just kind of, that's what spawned the HPs and all the other little companies that came up around it. And you had to get creative because you were basically in commando mode. There was the corporate structure had been like come, the ladder had been taken out of at the foot of the thing, and so like you know all these MBAs that graduated in the late 80s and early 90s, there was no more jobs for them. We were in a recession. So you had to fend for yourself, and you had to be much more creative. And now the millennials have that same sort of distasteful kind of saccharine boomer entitlement. Like, you know, show me to my corner office, you know.
Yeah, no, they do. You know, I'll tell you something. Every reading I've done, when there's a Q&A afterwards or a panel discussion, if I use the word entitlement, it's like, a gospel chorus comes back at me. It's like, yeah, man, tell it, brother. Like, I literally hear people, like, release all this negative energy they've wanted to release about millennials and their entitlement. Now, right now, the millennials are probably getting whacked pretty hard by economic realities, just as you and I did in the late 80s, early 90s. So my mercy upon them, and, you know. But it's hard not to feel a little bit of glee at their comeuppance, because the fact is, like, I've worked by, you know, alongside so many interns, some of whom were fantastic, brilliant, dynamic people. So, you know, I don't want to generalize too much, but there's always that person who's like, yeah, hey, I wanted to talk to you because I want to be, like, editor-in-chief of the magazine by the time I'm 25. Actually, I was hoping maybe, like, next year I wanted to maybe, like, run a magazine, and I'm wondering if you could tell me how. And I'm like, what? Dude. I mean, I worked at newspapers for 6 years before I even came to New York to work in magazines. And, you know, the editor-in-chief worked a variety of different – he even got the job fairly young, but he already had a ton of experience under his belt. The idea of paying your dues and getting experience is anathema to them, to the millennials. They can't even contemplate it. And, well, I think they'll probably learn a lot about that now. I mean, you're right. Like, it's a really good point about – that late 80s, early 90s thing where we got called slackers. I mean, I slacked for a while, I admit it. It's because I couldn't find work, you know?
Yeah, that's the thing. They think that was like a choice.
No, I would have probably... I'm actually glad I went through it because it made me a lot hungrier and probably toughened me up. I was actually kind of a wussy rich kid, and it forced me to, like, fight to you know, get the kind of job I wanted to get. I mean, I remember, this was before email, but it really was before email. And I graduated in college in 1988, and I would have to go, print out, type up my resume, like on a typewriter,
to
go down to Kinko's and Xerox it, and Xerox off my newspaper clips, and then go to the post office and mail it to various newspapers, and you know, of course, hear nothing back. Or if I heard anything back, it would be like, well, we have a hiring freeze, or there are cutbacks. So, you know, you had to, am I into this? Am I not into this? Am I committed? You had to really ask yourself those questions and plow ahead. And just like you're saying, be inventive. My choices were actually fairly conservative, lowercase c. Like, you know, I still stayed in newspapers, fairly traditional. But, I mean, you know, there are people who started dot-coms in that era. They did startups. They started bands. They started indie, you know, they shot indie films that they brought to Sundance because they couldn't find anything else to do, which is great. You know, and in a weird way, the slacker era was a point at which we planted seeds for a technological revolution. You know, it's sort of the point at which it led to a sort of cultural blossoming in this country. You know, it was not as much of a shrinkage as people would think. So
no, we like I said, we were put underground, and then we got good at being underground.
Yeah.
And then we created a whole bunch of shortcuts and a sort of like background village that, of course, was commoditized and then almost sort of vilified in a way, because it was like the boomers look at that as like a no fair. Like, we had you guys squashed, and you keep coming back like bad pennies, you know?
I know, that's right.
And I think they resented it because when they pedestalized the Britney Spears and all these, you know, people that came through, you know, 10 years later, you didn't see the same backlash that the grunge guys got when we became sick of them.
Yeah,
they just found another wave of them. You know, they just kept them up there, and so it just bugs me that they just got away with that. But actually, we have a caller here. Let's see, we'll punch him in.
Oh, cool.
All right, so you're on the air with Jeff and the rest of us here. Go ahead.
I am.
Yep, you're on. Go.
I was just wondering, what is your definition strictly for the millennials? And I remember you had said something about a utopia. You don't think that because I'm myself in 20, almost 21.
Uh-huh.
So I'm just trying to figure out. I'm trying to figure out because everywhere I go in college and even when I was growing up, everyone was telling me your generation is the generation that's gonna, you know, take us out of this big bubble that we're all in, and you're our future in the whole thing. And yet I look around, and even being Generation Y or whatnot, or even X, I look around, I'm like, no, I'm not.
What's your name?
Justin.
Justin, how you doing, Justin?
Justin Steinberg, yeah.
Well, the thing is about the different generational dates of when people were born, it's a little bit flexible in a strange way, that I found that demographers, demographic experts would have different dates for Generation X. But if we're being loose, the baby boom sort of bleeds into the early 60s. So it's people born right after World War II into maybe early 60s. Then you could start saying that people born in 61 and onwards are Generation Xers. There's some pretty key people born in 1961. Barack Obama happens to be one of them, but also Doug Rushkoff, who we mentioned, and Doug Copeland, who wrote the original Generation X novel, and Richard Linklater, who made the film Slacker, they were both born in 61. So that sensibility, clearly, Slacker and Generation X, the novel, sort of defined what Xers are, so clearly it starts with people born around then. And I would say that the millennials start being born around the last days of disco, sort of late 70s, early 80s. I mean, if you're born in the 80s, or shortly after that.
88 for me.
Oh, yeah, you're definitely a millennial. Yeah.
Well, you're
typically, like, if you're born, like, they're Reagan era kids, you know? They're like kids of that Reagan boom. Although, if you're born in 88, you were born when that was ending, because the stock market crash was October 19th, 1987, as I remember vividly.
Ollie North was on trial around then when he was born.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But, I mean, you witnessed a different, obviously, a different time than I did, or that Mark did. And, I mean, that's a thing. Like, people say, oh, you're making generalizations about these different generations. Here's the thing. I marinated in different media than you did, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
Justin, you grew up with a completely different approach to media, to the Internet, to video games, to film, than I did. You know, so like Mark and I probably share a whole lot in common, even if we grew up in different places, because we watch the same reruns on TV, we listen to similar music, we were under the shadow of the boomers in the same way. And so I think that creates, like, I'll meet Xers of all different backgrounds, all different ethnic and geographical backgrounds, and we find a lot of commonality because of that media that we were brined in, basically. And so for you, it's very different. But, like, how do you feel about your generation, Justin?
A lot of times that a lot of pressure is put on our generation
because
it's, I know I, from what I've learned, I think it was the 80s and 90s, there was a lot of, the birth rates were somewhat lower than normal and whatnot, and it started off in the late 70s. And so, basically they're like, all right, maybe you can start, you can start having children earlier, like our generation, like your generation and whatnot, because I'm 20 years old. I have an older sister who's 28, and my parents are still looking at her like, "All right, you're not married. Come on."
Oh,
and
really? Yeah.
It's the same situation. And I look around, and many people who are in their late 20s or early 30s, and that aren't with anyone else or whatnot, or aren't having children. It's sort of, and the same thing with us in the lower 20s. It's sort of like a little bit of pressurized to have the next generation quickly, because it wasn't. It's in our day and age right now, it's, okay, you can wait till you're 25 or wait till you're 26 to go meet someone, versus back in my parents' time, whatever, whatnot, it was, you know each other from when you're late teens, early 20s, you're already getting married.
Yeah.
So, and that's just from the marriage side and that sort of thing. In many other regards, the pressure comes from regardless of school and whatnot, but the whole election with Obama and McCain, that whole thing, a lot of pressure was put on our generation of the anyone who was the new 18, who just became 18-year-old all the way up to the mid-20s, because we're now the ones who get to now elect, and so all that media attention was put on us, and in many regards, I don't think we sort of lived up to everyone's standards of it, because you just look around, and a lot of people are like, all right, yeah, they voted, they did what they had to, but it's not what everyone was really hoping for. It's we came out, we did what we had to, but everyone looks around and says, oh, this is it. So.
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, I slag on your generation pretty hard in my book, but when the Obama campaign came around, I found myself biting my tongue a bit. Like, I found myself being impressed by your generation in a way, because I saw millennials doing something that a lot of Xers probably wouldn't. Now, granted, one reason I wouldn't is because I have two kids now and I'm busy and I don't have time to go, like, register voters in Iowa, you know,
right.
When I was 25 maybe, but not now. And so, you know, you had people your age or a little older working on not just the Obama campaign, on all these different campaigns, getting really involved in the political process, registering voters, you know, showing up at rallies, getting pumped. I mean, us Xers tend to be too cynical to do sometimes.
And Jason, I was
impressed. I mean, that was like, that, you know, it's cool to see. I think that there was a degree of idealism to it that was both refreshing and a little distressing, too, because I think you're probably going to get burned. You'll probably see that all your, you know, sort of pie-eyed idealism will get shot to hell a little bit. But that's growing up.
and, yeah, I want to bridge on that. And Jason, thanks for the call, because he touched on a couple of topics there. All these conventional things to do, go to get an education, then get a job, then get married, that linear sort of building blocks that the boomers perfected in a way.
Yeah.
In their idealistic notion of having the American dream and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then we didn't buy any of it. So
right.
We tore apart every institution you could tear apart. We reversed it. We became webmasters at 18 years old. And, you know,
right.
And then completely reverse engineered the whole thing. We've tore apart marriage to the point now where no one knows what the heck it is. They've debated from coast to coast what the heck a marriage even is anymore. So we've completely thrown everything into the bucket on that. And then he talked about political activism. It, almost like you say, this notion of having pressure to vote, I never felt it. Growing up, I mean, I was in college for both Reagan elections, undergrad and grad school, and both times, both campaigns, I said, if they elect this old idiot, we deserve what we get.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, what were your choices? I mean, it was like a parallel universe going by.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, yeah. These guys. It's almost like they're expected to have a position on every issue.
Yeah, that's true.
At 18, 19, 20 years old, when you're mostly worried about how to get laid. You know, it's like, I can't extrapolate what's going on in Afghanistan. You know, it's just strange. And the thing is, we grew up, again, no draft, you know, volunteer army. Yeah, I put on the BlogSoma.net to preview the show a clip from Stripes and a clip from Fight Club.
Awesome.
To show the contrast. You know, in 81 and 99, about, you know, how a generation communicates with itself.
Yeah.
And you could see that the complete pendulum swing from the early 80s, sort of kind of like almost like half boomer, half Xer, kind of like, you know, again, that fake, draggy kind of thing going on where it's like you can't really tell. They're a group, but they really don't want to be a group.
Yeah.
And then you see Fight Club where everybody's on their own, and he completely puts to bed any notion of any kind of you say utopian ending, any kind of happy ending of anything. It's like, look, you're all part of the whole, you know, dirt of the world or whatever.
Yeah. What's interesting about Fight Club is that part of what drives the Edward Norton character essentially to madness is being a yuppie. Like,
right.
I mean, actually, what that film largely is an excoriation of consumerist culture, because there's these great scenes early on where Edward Norton's character is talking about, I had become a slave to the IKEA nesting instinct. And, like, I loved every stick of furniture in that apartment or in that condo. Like, he's in love with catalogs and his furniture and his little kitchen doodads. And that's part of what drives him to the Fight Club is because he realizes he's become this kind of consumerized wuss and he's lost some kind of natural instinct or something. And it's in some ways the opposite evolution of the boomers, who seem to largely embrace yuppiedom
and
jump in head first. Yeah, you know, let me talk. Can I talk about something? This is really interesting because I was at a conference. Well, it's like this conversation salon type thing they have out at the Philip Johnson Glass House in Connecticut. In New Canaan, Connecticut. I was out at that last week because they had me moderate some kind of panel there, and it was a cool thing. And one of the people on the panel was named Valerie Casey, who's an Xer and is from IDEO, the design firm, but she's also started this thing called Designers Accord. And what Designers Accord is basically a coalition of like 100,000 designers from around the country who are asking a really simple question. Do we need to make this thing? Okay, so like they're hired to design a thing that will probably, you know, eat up tons of natural resources and pollute the environment. So they're asking a question, does the world need this thing? Can we ask that before we build it and waste all those resources? And like, for instance, Valerie said she was inspired by hearing about that she was, you know, a team was working on designing a new diaper Mm-hmm. Okay? So, like, I mean, I'm not particularly pious about this stuff, but, you know, diapers are pretty polluting as it is. And this was like a new kind of diaper that would have a little sensor in it, like an electronic sensor, so if the baby wet the diaper, it would, like, buzz. Now, first of all, that's going to traumatize a lot of kids. I'm a parent,
oh my God,
I can
yeah,
tell
imagine.
You. That's a terrifying idea. But secondly, you know, that it would, so you can have, like magnetic or electronic material in the landfills then? I mean, because when you're dealing with a baby, you don't have time to, like, take that little thing out or what, you know.
Right.
So Valerie's like, before we spend all this time and effort and money to develop this diaper, do we need the diaper? Okay? Do we even need to make it? So she started this group, Designers Accord, to just simply ask that question in the business sphere, which I think is so brave and inspiring and very much counter, I think, to the boomer model. Because the boomer model strikes me, at least up until, you know, recently when we've become all more eco-conscious, was basically like, let's make more stuff. Let's make more stuff, because if we make more stuff, we'll make more money, and we'll solve problems by making more stuff. There must be something new we can make that's better than the old stuff we make, so we'll make something new. Whereas Valerie's saying, do we need to make any of it? Like, you know, this is the endless Mobius strip, the endless vortex of consumerism that's basically, you know, turned our economy topsy-turvy. So
what's sort of the should-we segment of the population? Because they're all the boomer mentality was always, can we?
Yes.
And once they figured out if they could, they did.
That's right.
They,
yeah.
And they never had any kind of a gap in between in the synapse that said, should we?
Should we?
Because they never thought forward. They never had, for all their greenness, and you can get into things like Ken Wilber's boomeritis and the mean green gene and all that stuff. you talk about spiral dynamics and how the collective and all that stuff. But for all of that stuff that came out of the 60s, a lot of their, I guess, you know, sort of awakening came from screwing things up. And then they would do a can we to fix it. You know, so
yeah, that's right. Let's make something else that will be the solution.
So then they create a problem and solve a problem, and then they take credit for both. You know, but so our thing was always should we, because we didn't have a lot of resources. We didn't get a lot of corporate funding. We didn't get sponsored by, you know, all these big global corporations. We were all little pockets in between. So we had to sort of measure where we were going to point our arrows and say, should we shoot there or should we shoot there?
Yeah.
And we were very sort of efficient in the way that we created stuff. So that way, you know, like something simple, like just trying to think back early 90s, like when the transition went from AOL and Netscape were battling it out for who was going to be the server, you know, who was going to be the search engine stuff. And then, boom, Yahoo, it took over. Because Yahoo was sitting in the weeds watching this stuff and figuring out where both of them were missing the boat. And I remember, like, I think it was Wired Magazine, one of them, they were talking about how soon everything was going to be going to the servers. And then Google, of course, leapfrogged over both of them. And, you know, so it's like our learning curve was always like, wait, watch, see what's good about this and what's good about that, and then create a next generation that's even better. Like, Facebook is better than MySpace.
Yeah.
And Twitter,
oh yeah.
And Twitter's going to outdo Facebook because it's even faster. So,
right.
You know, and then the second generation iPhones and all that stuff. So our thing is, I think, is our contribution anyway, is sort of this. I hate to say it, but sort of a spiritual pragmatism. It's like we want to be creative, but we don't want to be stupid. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a line in Slacker that this makes me think of, which is well, there's a scene in Slacker where they pull these cards. I write about this later in the book. The cards they're pulling are Oblique Strategies cards.
Yes, I love those cards.
Yeah,
Brian Eno
and Peter Schmidt, this artist, developed these. They're really cool things. And, like, you know, Brian Eno uses them to sort of blast through creative roadblocks in the studio with U2 or something, or Bowie or whatever. And, like, you pull a card and it'll say a random thing. And you apply that to whatever creative task you're doing. It kind of just disorient, you know, like to just willfully disorient where you are. So the card that the guy pulls or the woman pulls, I don't remember who it is at the moment, in Slacker is, withdrawing in disgust is not the same thing as apathy. Which I think is really a cool line, and, like, I can see why it's in the film, because I'm sure people would see, you know, boomers see these Slackers in Austin and in the movie and say, oh, well, they're just apathetic you know, losers.
Right.
That's not the case. They're making a point by withdrawing in disgust or withdrawing just from a spirit of questioning. Like, do we want to make this thing? Do we want to do this thing? Do we want to participate in this thing that can often be destructive, personally destructive and globally destructive? Do we want to do it? Like,
right.
That's worth asking, you know? Now, some of it sold out in many ways. I certainly did. I'm not going to throw stones. I mean, you know, I work for mainstream magazines, and I'm proud of the work I do. But, you know, I think the people who ask those questions are really courageous. I think there's something heroic about that, frankly. I think that whole slacker thing is one of the most misinterpreted little movements in American life. I mean, these are people who were just trying to do the American experience in a different way, you know, by asking questions. I'm sorry I keep babbling, but that's something I feel passionate about.
The characterization was coming from our critics, which were the boomers. We weren't buying along with their deal, and so
that's right. We weren't playing ball. We weren't playing ball. That's the problem, is that their little marketing executives in the corner offices were freaking out because we weren't just lock, stock, and barrel buying their stupid products. We weren't buying their stupid, cheesy bands they were trying to stuff down our throat. We had our own bands. We had our own interests. We didn't, you know, we liked the Smiths. We liked the Jam. We liked, you know, Eric B. and Rakim. We liked, you know, all this, the Sonic Youth, the Replacements, all the stuff that led up to Nirvana, that was like on indie labels and came from weird little regional scenes, REM, etc., you know, and was on college radio. And you know, like when Nirvana broke through, that was awesome. It was fun. I loved the band. I loved the band. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't as much, but I thought they were great. But the thing is, they were certainly not the beginning of the alternative movement, which is one of the dumbest things I ever heard in my life. I mean, I was on college radio in the 80s, and I was already late to the party. I mean, the alternative scene was going on for a good 15 years, and what happened with Nirvana was just the culmination of that in a way. It was like the sound of Husker Du and the Pixies and the Replacements and even all the way back to the Sex Pistols finally coalescing into something that broke through in a mainstream way, you know?
I mean, I'm back in Albany in the early, mid-80s, and it's like you can go 4 days in a row and see Black Flag and see Chili Peppers and see Butthole Surfers. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, they were playing every little club in Albany back then, you know, Lark Street and RPI. And then, like, the alarm would come through, and it's like,
the alarm.
And it was like this, like, bizarre muting, because nothing made sense. And there was always, some dude selling a Dead Kennedys, bootleg somewhere. And meanwhile, you always had, the Springsteens and the overarching, boomer acts that would come through in the summer. And it was like, those guys were never going to play Jones Beach. I think there was sort of like, and again, this is part of the non-utopian view that you're talking about, is that I think maybe Gen X, because of the fact that we didn't live in a linear way, we don't really have a destination in the future that we can point to and say we're going to go from A to B to C. So when you're coming through, you don't think about the next step. It's like we kind of build one-floor visions and walk through them from front to back, close the door, and go on to the next one, where everybody else seems to build these vertical things that have all this infrastructure, and we're thinking about how we're going to put, a garden on the 16th floor and a wading pool on the 40th floor, and so their thing is much, much more about edifice and much, much more about visibility, and ours is much more, I think, for just out of habit, is much more kind of sustenance farming. You know, we don't think far ahead, or we don't have the ability. It's almost like not myopic, but we're sort of kind of content with what we can see.
Okay, that's what I think is saving the world. See, that's exactly why I did use the title X Saves the World, because I agree with you completely. And, like, here's an example. This guy, Fritz Haig, H-A-E-G, he appears later in the book. He's become a friend of mine, and he does a lot of things. He's an architect and runs these salons and all these different things. But the main thing he's known for at this point is this movement. It's not even a movement. It's just like his little thing called Edible Estates. And Edible Estates is all about a very simple thing. He started at one house in suburban Kansas. That's how he started the whole thing. One house.
Okay.
Not 800,000 houses in a boomer way. One house. And all it is he encouraged this family in Kansas, in Salina, Kansas, to replace their lawn, which wastes all sorts of resources, a front lawn, with a garden. That's it. Okay? And so he worked with them for a whole season to build a garden, and now they have a working garden in their front lawn. And that spread virally from that little lawn. He did them, and he did an edible estates on the West Coast, on the East Coast. He did one at the Tate Modern in London. And he started speaking all over the place about this. He's not some demagogue. He's not trying to lead a movement. He's just trying to plant that seed of an idea that, hey, you know, just like you said, sustenance farming. You know, you could grow peppers and corn and tomatoes right on your land, this land that surrounds your little house. And it might be a little plot of land, as it is in my situation, but mm-hmm. you could grow a lot of great stuff. And it will make you think differently about the land you're on, make you think differently about the food you eat, make your neighbors think differently about the possibilities. And that just struck me as really an X thing. You know, like he doesn't want... I don't know. He's not like trying to lead some march, you know, about it, or you know, picket, or it's just like, hey, build a garden. What a like simple idea, you know, but actually pretty transformative. If you have kids in particular, you know, for them to get a chance to do that, to work on that, it can be really a life changing thing. So I've always distrusted movement.
You fell in love with your generation writing this book, didn't you?
What's that?
You sort of fell in love with your generation in writing
the book. A little bit. Yeah. Well, that's a really good point. That's an interesting point because I think a lot of extras like, yeah, I'm not part of that. I don't even know what it is. I'm not that. Mm-hmm. And then I started meeting these people like Fritz Haig and Matthew Zapruder and Joshua Beckman. I was like, these are pretty amazing people. Like, and I do feel in sync with where they're coming from, and I do like the way they're going about it. I mean, like, I've gotten slagged on by some people for including this chapter. Well, it's just a little section on this poetry bus, because Joshua Beckman and Matthew Zapruder, they're the co-editors-in-chief of a publishing house called Wave Books in Seattle. It's like a little publishing house that only publishes poetry and these beautiful sort of objects of books that they put all this effort into designing. And they're both poets, too. They're great. But, you know, I went on the road with this bus because I like Tom Wolfe, and it seemed like kind of, you know, Ken Kesey electric Kool-Aid acid test thing to do, but from a Gen X standpoint. And, you know, basically these guys would roll this bus, and they went into 50 cities. They would roll into Spokane or Missoula or wherever and walk off the bus and read poetry on a ranch or in a sushi bar, literally in a sushi bar or in, you know, a tavern. Or, you know, sometimes in a college. But it almost seemed fruitless in a way. I mean, like, you know, what the hell impact is this going to make on American culture? But the way they saw it was very similar, I think, to the way Fritz Haig sees the edible estates, which is like, we're going to plant seeds, right? I happen to be a poetry junkie, so I'm not, like, even the word poetry is something people can make fun of. But, like, I thought it was beautiful because, like, I grew up in a very conservative Republican environment, and mm-hmm. my first exposure to punk rock and also to poets, largely, I admit, like, beat poets like Allen Ginsberg and stuff, was hugely transformative in my life. Like, it changed my way of thinking. So their thinking was, I'll roll into Spokane, maybe 10 kids hear us, and it just rocks their world, right? And maybe they pick up poetry, or maybe they pick up a guitar. Who knows? But it plants that seed, you know? And I thought that was great. I mean, they got almost no press. You can Google Poetry Bus, and believe me, there's not much out there. It didn't turn into some boomer movement. They didn't have, like, you know, hordes of hippies following them. It wasn't at all.
It's creative in a self-referencing way, where there's almost, like I said, everything the boomers did, there always has to be a damn revolution around it, and there has to be meetings, and we have to march on something and write a senator, and this guy just does his thing and leaves his footprint that way, it doesn't go global, and but it's like some of the stuff we do in semantics here. You know, all we're trying to say is that you're more than what you think you are, and you're more than what the shrink said. You're more than your labels you got, and we give them a process to work through. Like we kind of toss around this word eco, but it just means that your eco-somatic means your brain's wired toward the environment more than toward yourself, and that's pretty much the theme. You and me being both ecos, it's pretty much the theme of Xers. Is that I was saying in one of my emails back and forth here was that it seems like the millennials and also the and the boomers were more prone towards the philo sort of way of being away, where it was all about relationship and group, and also the onto, where it's like the alpha male and the leader, and best and better and better and better. And our thing was sort of like EXO in the sense that we were trying to like basically put down a sort of a stability to things, like you said, that should be kind of thing, and being more pragmatic. And then also the ego part where it's passion, but it's personal passion. I'm not trying to make you believe like me. I'm just going to make sure that you have the freedom to believe what you want, and I'm not going to crowd you with it. So you can have, like, that's why when we kind of tore apart Coconuts and, like, covered all those music stores where they couldn't put these things into genres anymore because everything was kind of glomming together. Now it's like they got to put classic over here and this kind of rock over there. And everybody else before and after us seemed to like the categories, and we never liked the categories.
Right.
And that sort of leads to a lot of sort of, like, you know, frustration because they can't program us.
Right.
And it's like we kind of fought that that imprint, and as, you know, kind of winding down here, what's the number one issue? Like, what's the follow-up? We're getting into midlife, you know, we're going to start getting an AARP card soon, you know. So now we have our opportunity to really kind of, like, almost kind of drive the cultural bus here. And since Xers seem to be more tied to their local niche, you know, and not this big kind of, you know, diffuse demographic thing, what's the number one issue facing a Gen Xer as he goes in through his 40s into midlife, into his 50s, and has to deal with the fact that these damn millennials are going to start, you know, sort of, I don't want to say sort of aping, but definitely reading the script of what their parents gave them to sort of knock us out of the box again?
Well, here's what that's a really good question, and I actually feel this happening. I see it anecdotally with people I know, and I think it's something we're going to start seeing, which is, many of us, I'm 42, many of us Xers took a course in life that maybe we didn't expect to take, okay? And that's fine. Like, I pass no judgment. Everyone goes the way they go, and, you know, you make the decisions and compromises you have to make along the way, right? But this economic collapse is forcing us, a lot of us, to reevaluate what we wanted to do originally. And, you know, if you're in a position, like, look, a lot of us, a lot of us were suckered by yuppie stuff. I found myself in the 90s looking at my 401k allocation, you know, watching the stock market. Oh, my God, it's up today. I'm actually, you know, I'm doing well. I just made some money. You know, I got suckered into that, too. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's human, I guess, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm certainly pretty yuppie when it comes to good cheese and wine and
cheese.
Know,
there's all about cheese in the book.
Yeah, I like cheese. And you know, I joke around that my gateway drug was olive oil. I really like, you know, but nevertheless, I have found a lot of my friends thinking, hey, and maybe you've encountered this too. Like, if the bottom drops out, you know, and I really do lose my job and like lose some of the financial stability I've built up, and I can't be a yuppie anymore, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's not the end of the world, because maybe, like, it's time to start focusing on my community in a different way. Maybe it's time to start volunteering. Maybe it's time to start getting back to that screenplay or that novel or that, you know, acting career or you know, being a yoga instructor, whatever it is. Maybe it's time to, like, reevaluate whether happiness was really, you know, the source of happiness was really that kind of yuppie pursuit you were caught up in. I mean, I know that a bunch of my friends here north of the city. This is just casual, but I, like, obviously have a lot of friends in quote-unquote media and magazine people and stuff. And we were just really inspired by David Eggers, and his 826 Valencia program. I mean, if you don't know about this, he started this kind of writing workshop and literacy program in San Francisco called 826 Valencia.
Mm-hmm.
And now that's spread virally to all these different cities, Seattle, Chicago, Brooklyn, Boston, I believe. And it's basically a really fun place where kids can go and work with really top-notch writers and editors to learn, you know, to write stories and, you know, read more and get kind of energized about the written word. But it's very local. And it's not, again, it doesn't have that kind of, it doesn't smack of movementism. It's just a very kind of local, dug into the community kind of like outpost to make that happen. So, like, some friends of mine, you know, and if there's people listening who are into this, call us up. You know, we were thinking we should have an 826 Hudson Valley, you know, 826 Yonkers or something, like, you know, to serve people north of the city, particularly in the Bronx and Yonkers, Ossining, maybe people who are not, you know, are underserved in that way, don't have a community outlet like that. I've never thought of myself thinking that. I've never talked that way, man. I'm, like, not really a do-gooder at heart, but I found...
You're doing it again. It's like that thing, I want to do this really good, heartfelt thing, but I'm really not one of those
guys. No, no, but I'm saying, like, this is new to me. I mean, I'm not, I'm really not very, I don't know. I think in some ways I've been pretty selfish in pursuit of my career, but suddenly I'm very energized by this idea, and I think it would be beautiful to do that and to give back. And the problem I have with it is, frankly, just the terminology. It's like, so you hear, like, give back and empowerment and community. There's something about those words that is,
well,
kind of boomer overuse.
Yeah, they have that 1984 kind of double talk to them, you know.
Yeah, so, I mean, I just think it would be fun to talk about. Like, I love books. I'm sitting here in my office surrounded by books.
Mm-hmm.
Books are, you know, in a crisis. Book publishing is a crisis right now. I would like to get young people, creative people, energized about books. I think that would be great. So, you know, I hope maybe we'll, you know, raise money. I know a friend of mine who's an editor here actually knows Dave Eggers somehow and reached out to him and already sort of floated the balloon. So that would be cool, you know. So, I mean, I like, this is the thing. I'm not interested in doing something in Bolivia, you know, or like, you know, I'm interested in doing something right here in my town. You know, and
right.
Like, that's the thing. That's the difference. I don't even really care if it spreads. I just would like to improve the area I live in, whether it's creating a garden or working with kids to get them energized about writing, or to, you know, support the local farmer's market. You know what I mean? Like, I mean,
hordes of 20-somethings with their Kindles, you know, migrating to Westchester for you.
That's cool. I don't care if they read on their Kindles. I just, like, you know,
yeah, I was saying,
just read and just discover stuff. I mean, like, discovering, you know, I don't know what it could be, Henry Miller, or, you know, there's a lot of punk stuff out there that they might discover and think is pretty cool, but, like, how are they going to find it these days? I don't know. I just think that this is this whole, you know, the thing is, I've always felt more comfortable. I don't mean to be flippant here, but I've always felt more comfortable in times of, like, an economic crash. I think that's a very extra thing. I always think these booms are suspicious, and I always get really scared during the boom time. First of all, you get jealous because you feel like you're missing out. And secondly, I get scared, like, hey, this doesn't feel good. If this starts getting bigger and bigger, it's going to topple, you know, because I've seen it happen over and over. You know, we saw 1987, stock market crash. And 2000, the dot-com meltdown. You know, now we're going through something that's, like, cataclysmic and huge, and I don't even understand. But
I personally rank, like, movies like Wall Street as, like, horror movies to me, because it's like you watch them now, and it's the same. I mean, you watch Talking Heads on TV go by, and you talk about it early in the book that extras have a thing with money that, I mean, we're all basically dealing with the same existential angst across the generation, is that, because the boomers were so greedy, I mean,
yeah.
You can't get any more greedy as a generation. There's so many of them, and they got so much, and they always wanted more, and they always got more than they ever thought they'd get, and they never really shared it with anybody else. Then the millennials come along, they're twice as greedy. I mean, they have that empowerment, entitlement thing going on.
Yeah.
And then there's us, and we were always told, pay your dues, like you said, and then we do, and then they move the ladder. So it's like, for us, we're always sort of that Sorry Charlie kind of generation that just seems to chase the dollar, like on the cover of the Nirvana, but never mind.
Yeah.
We never
right.
quite get there. Even if we, it's almost like if we got the dollar, it's almost like the coyote catching the roadrunner. It's like we think the cartoon's over. So it's like this kind of love-hate relationship with wealth, and that's why we had people on talking about the secret last week about abundance and all these people buying into the secret and the bleep and the quantum this, and I sit still and I can control the red lights here on Post Road. And you know, it makes you crazy because you create your own reality. And it's like, there's always some billionaire telling you how he created his own reality, sits on his ass staring at a vision board. Like, no! You did the stuff I'm watching on TV every day.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, I think you kind of touched on it, is that we kind of went around a circle on it, but just to kind of wrap it up, the book gets into sort of a cross-section of the way people in Gen X perceive themselves over time and how they've been perceived from outside their generation, both before and after, and then what's the resolution of that. And you went through this entire arc of it's over, forking us, kind of the beginning of it. We always kind of start off with this sort of negentropic thing going on with the Xers. And then you sort of say, you know what, we're still here. We're not dead yet. We're still here. And it's sort of like this kind of flotsam zombiness that goes on with us, that we're not, we haven't fallen off the cliff here. Like, again, going back to Wile E. Coyote, we haven't looked down. We've gone over the cliff. But for some reason, we have this sort of like the bug that won't get flushed sort of thing going on that seems to defy reason, because we've had less opportunity, more because of the numbers, 46 million as opposed to 76, just the sheer numbers to fight for positions and things like that. But yet, some of us have squirted through. Like you mentioned, you know, Barack Obama, pretty good. And I look, like I said, Rushkoff to me is the Buggles of the internet. He declared before it was going to happen that this was going to be a good thing gone bad if we didn't watch out. And he's very, if you get into some stuff with Rushkoff, he takes it extremely personal the way that the web went, and how it could still be sort of like kind of pulled back the other way. So we have a social role, like I said. We're the only ones that are honest enough with ourselves to know that when we're being phony. And that creates this sort of, I don't know, kind of backwards sort of authenticity that doesn't need a corporate flag, doesn't need a slogan. Maybe it needs one of these oblique strategies. You know, like I found one on the floor where you were talking to me. I went to my room and got, because I got one laying around on there.
Cool.
It says, take away as much mystery as possible. What is left?
Ah.
You know, those are the kind of questions I'll lay on a client when they're laying there going, really? Oh, what the hell's going on in my life? You know, because they're coming in from AIG or whatever, and they're laying on the table like, you know, forks in
That's
the body.
That's really interesting. Wow.
So
I like that. I try to take away the mystery with this book stuff, because like sometimes I find that people treat these authors like, I don't know, like mystics or something. Like
It's they like to pedestalize.
Ridiculous.
That's what's happened.
It's weird. Like they think we're like, you know. I mean, I don't know everything about everything. I mean, I know about stuff I wrote about in the book, but like, it's funny the kind of questions you get. You get asked about religion and geopolitics and gentrification, and I'm like, man, I don't have the answer to everything, I can assure you.
Charles Barkley said it in the 80s when he was playing ball, I'm not a role model, he's just a basketball player.
Yeah.
And he's lived up to that reputation in the last 25 years. But you look at what we expect of our athletes, our politicians, you think everyone's going to be a polymath because, you know, they can do one thing well, and then when you find out that they have flaws and they're not really good at relationships and they're not really good at managing their money, you know, it's sort of like there should be sort of that objects in the TV are not what they appear. You know, it got kind of a disclaimer on there, you know, to maybe make us stay sane. But your book is, like I said, it is a mirror. I recommend it to anyone between the ages of 30 and 49 before Logan's Run comes back for its 30-year reunion or something. They really ruin everything for us, but... I want to thank you for joining us here, and tomorrow you're going to be doing a panel over in Connecticut. Just give the...
It's in Soho, in downtown Manhattan.
Right.
Yeah, the McNally-Jackson bookstore.
Okay.
I don't actually remember the street address, but it's McNally-Jackson in Soho, and it's a panel with me, Doug Rushkoff, Jeff Chang, who wrote Can't Stop, Won't Stop, a great, great, I mean, truly probably the most brilliant book about hip-hop, and Kara Gisella, who... co-authored a book about Sassy Magazine, which was, you know, this bizarre Gen X approach to basically, a magazine for teenage girls, and the sort of the impact that had on American culture and a whole generation of girls. So, we're going to hear from all different viewpoints, which I think is good, you know, because sometimes this Gen X thing is always we white guys, you know, and I just like this can be really dull,
The Seinfeldification of America, you know, where there was never a black guy seen.
Yeah,
and then now of course it's the opposite. The white guy is kind of the guy that comes in as the fodder from the corner of the whatever programming it is. We've really, like I said, we're so as a generation, we're so over the argument that it's almost like we stare at people when they go, we're going to do this again.
Yeah.
And like I said, the millennials they'll fight about anything just to have their arms waving on TV sometimes. I mean, I remember when Geraldo went down, when the chair broke and they had. That was real, and it was
right.
And it's like now we create a whole show, Jerry Springer, where they fake fight every time. You know, 22 minutes after the hour, we fake fight, and it's like that's all we want. We want that food fight, sort of apocalyptic, without the consequences, hysteria without the hysteria thing going on. And I just think of that old Tom Petty song jamming me whenever I see that stuff. It's like, God, do they know not what they do? And a lot of times they, from dealing with Professor Val and some of her undergrad students and, our caller there, Jason, before, they don't know what to do because their instructions are coming from the people that sort of warped the culture so much that to follow them is to sort of warp it more. And so what are they going to listen to us? Because we're trying to just ignore it all. So it's very strange.
Yeah.
It's almost like we're all like kind of muted in little chat rooms, like funneling it through. But you gave us a great portal in this book, and I wish you luck with it. And the panel tomorrow night, if it's reposted anywhere or it's up on YouTube or there's a way to get it, just shoot me an email. I'll make sure everybody knows about it up here. And
okay.
You're always welcome back here on Summertime. Thanks for
okay, Mark.
Over.
Thanks so much. It was really a blast. It was really just a nice, natural conversation. I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, and say hi to everybody down there tomorrow, and we'll get Doug on in a couple months to get his book out there in June, and keep the corporate machine going, because you know what? We got to sell books at the end of the day. So thanks for joining us. Have a good
night. Okay, see you around. You too. Bye.
Take care. All right, so we learned a lot.
Yeah.
Are you still alive?
Barely awake.
It's way past your bedtime.
We went way over time.
Our one-hour show became 1 hour and 20 minutes, and so there. Next week, we're going to have a guy on about personal reinvention, so we will be talking the Boomer Talk next week with them and slashing and burning his ethos all over his face. So I will look at this. Play us out with a little Everybody Knows from Concrete Blonde.
Oh, I love Concrete Blonde.
That's right. Am I like you better if we slept together? Is that them?
No.
Who was that?
I just heard it today on the radio.
Yeah.
It's not them, though.
Same era, though.
Yeah.
Ah, God, it's kind of bugged me now. Right, I'm looking it up as we sit here. It's kind of bugged me. It's got a long name, too, right?
Huh?
The band that wrote that song. It's like that Dead or Alive song that's out now. You Spin Me Right Around. There's like a remix of that one out there now.
Oh, well, that's not good.
I might like you better. Damn it. There it is.
Romeo Void.
Hey, oh, you beat me to it, son of a bitch.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Never say never. Oh, Nickel Beer Night coming up. All right, we're off to chaos, and we're back next week with a report from academia as we journey up to Springfield to welcome in yet another layer of knowledge. So we'll see you next week.
I'll be looking forward to hearing about your report.
Oh, yeah, as I present my social synapse talk.
Be fantastic, and you'll be with your favorite roomie.
I must have, yes, that's it. Brother George will be journeying north with me. We'll be pontificating. Hopefully there'll be a Fitzy YouTube scene that I can hurl at their noses and see what the pointy heads have for me this year up in Chaos Land. So till then, next week, check the blog summer.net and, mind your P's and Q's. The country's going to hell. Travel light, everyone.
Bye.
Night.